The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And it is The Independent, and it's read by John Federson. This week's edition of The Independent is the 31st of July of 2025. And we better get down to it. First up now, an Ask Indy question. Election coming up, as we know from past week editions. In case you missed it, writes Chloe Bowl, a nonpartisan municipal election season is on us in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties. The candidates have filed their paperwork. Campaigns are beginning in earnest. Election day is just 3 short months away. There's no time like the present to get educated and make a plan to vote. For this week, Ask Indy, we've asked for your election-related questions. One reader wrote in, North Carolina has declared we all have an extra 2 years to renew our licenses, given the long lines at the DMV. Has the state clarified whether grace period IDs will be permitted for voting? And if not, can someone raise the alarm so voters don't get an unpleasant surprise when they show up to vote in municipal and midterm elections over the next two autumns? Answer, navigating ID rules can be tricky at the best of times, and the current moratorium on expirations adds another layer of confusion. Here is what you need to know. The grace period for renewing your driver's license only applies to driving. Per the North Carolina Department of Transportation, it does not apply to voting. However, if your license has expired within a year, North Carolina will still accept it as a form of photo ID, according to the State Board of Elections. So if you plan to use your driver's license to vote in November 4th, make sure its expiration date is November 4th, 2024, or later. That's 1 year ago. For the November 3rd, 26 midterm elections, a license with a date of expiration of November 3rd, 2025 or later will work. And after that, this doesn't apply to voters over 65 who can vote with an expired license as long as it was unexpired on their 65th birthday. If you're a voter whose driver's license will be more than a year out of date on election day, you have a few options. You could use a different type of photo ID, like a passport or military ID. There's a complete list of photo IDs accepted in North Carolina on IndyWeek.com and other places, too. Or you could walk into your county board of elections anytime before the end of the early voting period and get a free voter ID. Some county boards print the IDs on the spot, while others mail them to you. So consider getting this done as soon as possible, just to be safe. Then there's the obvious but onerous option of renewing your driver's license. You can do this in person, online, at a self-service kiosk, or in a few specific cases by mail. Renewing online is a good choice if you're eligible, but you can only do it for every other license renewal, and you can't get your first real ID online. In-person DMV appointments are notoriously hard to come by these days, so you'll probably have to walk in and wait in line. The North Carolina Reddit is a repository for theories of the best times and places to go to minimize your wait time, but conventional wisdom changes daily. All you can really do is show up early and hope for the best. While getting your ducks in a row, be sure to check your voter registration is up to date. Happy voting. Next, from Zebulon, a longish article, Zebulon's Municipal Government Meltdown, a timeline. The last time Zebulon elected a mayor in 2021, it was about as sleepy an electoral cycle As you could imagine, the outgoing mayor had decided not to run again after 28 years in office. Glenn York, a town commissioner at the time, ran and won easily against an opponent who had no government experience. Out of 8,000 residents, only 558 voted. 4 years later, the tiny town in eastern Wake County is gearing up for a very different mayoral race. For one thing, Glenn York is running for re-election, despite a chorus of calls for his removal from office. About as many people have signed a petition to that effect as elected him 4 years ago. Or another. Instead of one relatively weak opponent, York has four challengers this time around, two sitting town commissioners, one former commissioner, and a former town manager. Combine that crowded field with the fact that Zebulon has added 2,000 new residents since the last mayoral election, this race has the potential to be the most competitive in recent town history. But why are people calling for York's resignation, and why are so many candidates jostling to replace him? Residents of Zebulon have been complaining about their town board of commissioners, which includes the mayor, for months. They pointed to staffing vacancies, questionable hires, a lawsuit, and sudden resignations within town government as evidence that the board is untrustworthy or even corrupt. So, below comes a crash course on the municipal government meltdown in Zebulon. June 3rd, 2024, town manager Joe Moore resigns. By ABC 11's reporting, Moore served for 9 years, and the board accepted his resignation in a closed session. No public reason was given. June 4th, the next day, the town board hires Taiwo Jayoba to replace Moore on an interim basis. The vote was unanimous. According to meeting minutes, Jayoba had recently resigned as city manager of Greensboro following a workplace sexual harassment investigation and a separate incident of alleged domestic violence. July 2, 2024, town developers sue the town of Zebulon over a rezoning rejection, alleging commissioners had conflicts of interest. In May of 24, town staff recommended the board approve Deacon Development Group's proposal to build a 320-using housing development called Zebulon South near downtown, but the board rejected it in a 4-1 vote. Deacon's lawsuit alleges this rejection was arbitrary and illegal, with the developers claiming that multiple town commissioners had undisclosed personal reasons for voting against the proposal. Commissioner Shannon Baxter voted no in fear that the development would negatively impact her beekeeping business, Baxter's Bees, alleged this complaint. Baxter told WUNC, bee colonies in urban settings do very well, and it's a non-issue for the property in question. Also in the complaint, Commissioner Quentin Miles allegedly, quote, made racially and sexually charged statements about Deacon's counsel during the application process, quote, and indicated because he dislikes her, he would not approve any project in which she represents the applicant. Miles didn't respond to a request for comment. A jury trial is scheduled for November. All right, we're up to December 19th of 24. The town board hires Gilbert Todd as town manager. Todd was working in the town's public works department before he was elevated to the manager job, reports WRAL. April 17th, Todd resigns after 4 months. To fill his vacancy, the board appoints Jayoba as interim town manager for a second time. During a work session, Todd addressed the mayor and board, quote, recent developments involving a serious personnel matter have led me to a point where I can no longer continue in this role. I was placed in a position where I was expected to take action that I believe is unethical and inappropriate according to North Carolina general statutes. He said he was resigning effective immediately and walked out of the room. That day, he didn't offer any further explanation of the personnel matter that was the impetus for his resignation. The board again appointed Jay Obert to serve as interim town manager. Well, now we're up to April of 2025, and on the 21st, assistant town manager Kellyanne Williams resigns, and Todd says the board has asked him to place Williams on leave without cause. WRAL reported Todd said he was, quote, given a directive by the Board of Commissioners to place the assistant town manager on administrative leave with no grounds to do so. Todd told WRAL that Williams was, quote, an exemplary employee, and he decided to resign rather than put her on leave. The commissioners and Todd are legally barred from discussing the specifics of Williams' work performance, but Commissioner Shannon Baxter told WRAL, quote, the board never asked Todd to operate outside of his contract. April 28th, Zebulon residents launch a petition to replace the entire town board. They ask commissioners who are not up for election this fall, Baxter, Amber Davis, and Jessica Harrison, to resign by June 2nd, so a special election to choose their replacements could be held concurrently with the regular November 4 municipal election, and every sitting commissioner could be replaced. If Baxter, Davis, and Harrison did not resign, which they have not, the petitioners urged York to remove them, quote, for just cause, citing the rejection of the Zebulon South rezoning application, Moore's and Todd's resignation, Jay Ober's appointments, the board's failure to fill the town clerk position for more than 2 years, impacting transparency in operations, and the resulting backlog of missing public meeting minutes. The petitioners wrote, this is a genuine grassroots movement born from deep dissatisfaction with the current state of town governments. Each signature is a clear message to the Board of Commissioners that the widespread erosion of public trust is a crisis that demands immediate and decisive action. That petition has collected 423 signatures. All right, up to June the 30th. Commissioner Jessica Harrison launches her mayoral campaign. She didn't acknowledge the upheaval in town government in her campaign announcement. Instead, she focused on the town's rapid growth and promised to meet the moment with, quote, steady, capable leadership. July 10th, Todd announces he's running for mayor. His website emphasizes the need to restore public trust in town leadership. Quote, as your mayor, I will aim to restore faith and integrity to our town government by championing three core principles, truth, transparency, and togetherness, he writes. July 10th, York quietly files for re-election. The mayor doesn't appear to have a campaign website and has not responded to Indy's interview requests. Finally, July the 16th. Shannon Baxter and Larry Lauchs join the mayoral race. Baxter doesn't appear to have a campaign site or have made an official campaign announcement, but she filed her paperwork with the Wake Elections Board. Lauchs is a former one-term commissioner who served 29 years on the Town Board of Adjustment, 25 of them as a chair. He doesn't appear to have a campaign website, but wrote on Facebook he feels qualified to be mayor after his previous public service and 42 years spent in Zebulon. Lauchs happens to be the only registered Republican in the race. The other candidates are registered Democrats. And that just about brings us up to the present day. A few other noteworthy developments from this summer. A group called Move Zebulon Forward created a website in May encouraging people to vote and promising to convene community discussions about the upcoming election. Another group, the Zebulon Citizens Advisory Partnership, formed on Facebook in June and began hosting community meetings about town government issues. As of earlier this month, 6,881 people are registered to vote in Zebulon, and the candidate's first campaign finance reporting deadline was July the 25th, and Election Day is November 4. All right, next we move higher education, and two flagship universities in the Triangle area have financial pressure. First, UNC Chapel Hill unveils a plan to cut $70 million in response to funding pressure. Leaders revealed a plan on Wednesday to cut approximately $70 million in costs, 2% of its operating budget, over the next two fiscal years, ahead of anticipated federal and state funding reductions. Nate Knuffman, Vice Chancellor for Finance and Operations, said during a Board of Trustees committee meeting the plan includes a $17.2 million in cuts to non-resident financial aid. About $8.5 million in savings will come from administrative staff reductions in the first phase of a restructuring plan called Service First. Knuffman said the goal is to cut positions, quote, primarily through attrition. Another close to $4 million will be saved by eliminating vacant positions, and $10.3 million will come from what Knuffman called unit optimization of non-academic teams. The university said in a statement that leaders from athletics, student success, graduate school, and the North Carolina Collaboratory, that's a research funding agency established by the General Assembly, had volunteered to find cuts. It's unclear if the process would result in job reductions. The plan took some hints from the state Senate's budget proposal on areas to target. Knuffman said Chapel Hill would reduce spending by $4.8 million for academic centers and institutes and by $2 million for low-performing academic programs. Knuffman said no decisions have been made on what centers or programs are on the chopping block, and the university will engage the campus community on that process. They plan to reduce its spending by $29 million in fiscal 2026, with most of the other identified savings to be achieved by fiscal 27. Other areas facing cuts include $7.3 million from phasing out a faculty support program called Elevate, $9.2 million from reducing food procurement and purchasing costs, $1.9 million from increased use of incentives for early faculty retirement, $2.9 million in energy savings, and $1.5 million from other administrative efficiencies. Knuffman's presentation said that if federal or state cuts do not occur as expected, the savings would be reinvested in, quote, strategic priorities. So, Knuffman, Chancellor Lee Roberts, and Interim Provost James Dean wrote in a university-wide email shortly after the board's presentation, quote, our leadership team is taking a thoughtful and targeted approach, looking into areas that can be streamlined for greater efficiency, strengthening our operations while meeting our fiduciary responsibility to the people of North Carolina. Each of these decisions comes with true costs, yet we believe this measured approach will enable us to continue to pursue our goal of becoming the best public university in the country. The board instructed the university back in March to sequester $50 million in anticipation of financial challenges. Knuffman said the uncertainty about state and federal government funding influenced how the university thought about where to tighten its belt. And he pointed to reductions in federal grant money as one major factor. Research funding cuts from the National Institutes of Health and National Science Foundation could cost UNC Chapel Hill more than $100 million annually, according to Chronicle of Higher Education estimates. Chapel Hill is among many schools across the country grappling with those cuts. Duke University is trying to reduce its cost by $350 million, or about 10% of its expenses. And I'll read an article about that next. Chapel Hill is also bracing for proposed multi-million dollar reductions to parts of the university in the initial House and Senate budgets. While budget negotiations have stalled over House and Senate Republicans' tax cut disagreements, legislators are currently working on a mini-budget bill to fund some parts of the state government. Beyond a $3.5 million reduction in non-resident graduate tuition waivers, Knuffman said the mini-budget does not include big changes to Chapel Hill. The trustees lauded Kaufman's and the university's efforts to trim costs. Marty Kotis, the chair of Budget and Finance Committee, wrote, "We should always be finding cuts." He also praised the idea of reducing financial aid for non-resident students, quoting the state constitution's requirements that, quote, "the university be free as far as practicable for the state's people." It doesn't say people from other states, he added. Let the nonprofits and other groups, and there are lots, provide additional assistance to out-of-state students. Trustee Jim Blaine said he hoped more units beyond the four that agreed to proactively look for cuts would eventually be scrutinized as part of the unit optimization. And John Pryor, the outgoing board chair, remarked at the end of the presentation on how far he believes the university has come on budget and managing costs since he joined the board in 2019. And then that Duke article. Duke says 599 employees accepted a voluntary separation incentive program as part of the plan to reduce costs amid federal funding cuts by President Donald Trump. In a university-wide message on Friday, officials warned that, quote, involuntary staff reductions, known amongst commoners as layoffs, are coming next month. The news weighs heavily on all of us at Duke, said the message that broke the news to employees. Quote, between August 5 and 19, impacted employees will be contacted individually by their managers and will work closely with human resources through this transition. We recognize and are sorry for the impact these changes will have on our colleagues. The university did not detail how many employees it will lay off to reach its goal, but did note that, quote, the high number of voluntary participants means that fewer employees will be affected by this action. The message, signed by Duke's executive vice president and provost, noted that more than 250 additional faculty members, are currently considering voluntary incentives. It also doesn't clarify if any departments or units had enough voluntary separations to avoid these impending layoffs. Those who took the voluntary separation agreement, this is per a copy viewed by the Indy, will receive a lump sum of 2 weeks of pay for each complete year of work at Duke, up to a maximum of 1 year's pay. Those with less than 3 years' work will receive 6 weeks of pay. The agreement also requires that employees not apply for any jobs at Duke for the next 3 years. Duke announced that in April that it would be cutting 10%, or about $350 million, from its budget as the Trump administration slashed research funding and threatened other cuts. Officials said that the target was based on projection that the federal funding cuts and policy changes, including tiered tax rates on college endowments, could result in losses totaling as much as $500 million to $750 million. With more than 44,500 full-time and part-time employees between the university and its health system, Duke is the largest employer in Durham County and the second largest private employer in the state. In 2024, it paid $4 billion in salaries. While Duke planned to cut costs was already underway, the Wall Street Journal reported this week that Duke is one of the schools from which the White House is seeking to collect a fine for failing to, quote, stop anti-Semitism on campus, unquote. Per the blueprint of Columbia University's $200 million kowtow, an agreement with the Trump administration would presumably include a restoration of federal grants. Next, I'll move to Raleigh and Raleigh development about housing. Raleigh Townhomes Project, subject of Hayes Barton Homeowners lawsuit, has received approval. A Raleigh developer has notched a victory in a long contested quest to build 17 luxury townhomes on a 2.5-acre lot on Williamson Drive in the city's wealthy Hayes Barton neighborhood. Last week, Raleigh's Board of Adjustment, BOA, a quasi-judicial body that makes decisions on appeals for variances, special exceptions, and interpretations in the zoning regulations, ruled that a revised version of the townhome plan that conforms with the city's Unified Development Ordinance, UDO, may proceed. This decision comes after a group of homeowners back in 2023 filed a lawsuit against the developer, Johnny Chappell, and 908 Williamson, LLC, to stop the teardown of a historic home to make way for these townhomes. The townhomes plan was allowed under the city's then new missing middle housing policy. Approved by the City Council in 21 and 22, the policy allows for diverse types of infill development, known as missing middle housing, including townhomes, duplexes, and ADUs, to be built across the city. Additionally, in a case that is still pending, the homeowners are suing the city in an attempt to invalidate the missing middle policy and restore the city's original zoning rules. After the Board of Adjustment greenlit the project, a Wake County Superior Judge last summer blocked the development, writing in a remand order that the BOA had failed to apply a section of the UDO requiring compact subdivisions to be surrounded by a 20 to 35 foot deep transitional protective yard, TPY, or by wide perimeter lots. The UDO defines a TPI as a, quote, landscape yard area which contains no buildings, no vehicular service area, loading, storage, or display service areas. The judge ultimately revoked approval of the site plan but allowed them to resubmit the plan in compliance with the UDO. The city reviewed and approved the updated plan in April, and the homeowners appealed that decision to the BOA. An attorney, Michael Birch, at Longleaf Law Partners, who represents the developer, said in closing remarks during that hearing, "At the last appeal hearing, what we heard is that the appellants wanted a transitional protective yard. They wanted a screening wall. They wanted landscaping around the perimeter to protect their views into the site. And here we are, back." The judge said, "Provide a TPI." We've provided a TPI. We've even provided where we didn't have to. Provided a wall where we didn't have to. We've gone above and beyond trying to provide what they asked for, and we've done that, and we've complied with the UDO at the same time. Following nearly 8 hours of testimony spread across 2 days earlier this month, the BOA, in a 3-0 vote, gave its approval to the project. And the BOA, by the way, consists of 8 members. 1 member recused herself, and 4 others were absent for the hearing, though the board only needs 3 members to be present to constitute a quorum. The homeowners could again appeal the BOA's decision to the Wake County Court. Or I guess your next story here, originally from the Ninth Street Journal, is a little bit more lighthearted, at least I read it that way. Reclaiming Durham's paper streets with help from goats. What happens when community members, city officials, and goats come together? This isn't the start of a riddle or a punchy joke. It's a question asked by Mayor Leonardo Williams to a gathering on June 19th. That's when community members and city officials gathered behind the scrap exchange to witness the city's first reveal of a paper street. Paper streets are plots of land that are officially designated as roads and streets, but are undeveloped and unmaintained. These streets appear on paper, including maps and official city planning documents, but are virtually undetectable in real life. Because these plots are often a result of unexecuted urban planning, ownership is frequently disputed between private landowners and government agencies. The spaces often remain in limbo, and the result is frequent loitering, littering, and misuse of the property. Now, city officials are working to turn these plots into third spaces, and they're using goats to do it. Andrew Holland, director of the city's Office of Performance and Innovation, said the project grew out of conversations with the city's code enforcement divisions. Quote, they said they tend to see a lot of litter, a lot of overgrown vegetation on these paper streets. And when I heard that, my ears perked up and I was like, oh, what are paper streets? Well, there are approximately 700 such streets scattered throughout Durham, amounting to about 400 acres of unused land. As they looked further into the properties, Holland's team, in collaboration with the Parks and Rec, Transportation, Neighborhood Services, Code Enforcement and General Service, and the City Council Planning Department, recognized potential to harness. To gauge the possibilities of these forgotten plots, Holland initiated a collaboration with North Carolina State University's College of Design, where he is currently completing his doctorate. After multiple site visits, studio workshops, and meetings with city officials, students presented renderings of the way the land might be used. One student designed a park with overhead sculptures inspired by Durham's Hayti district, while another created a walkway blueprint that ties Durham's musical history with the sounds of nature. But before any improvements can be made, the land must first be cleared. On June 18th, Stephen Paul, operator of Goats on the Go, Raleigh-Durham, deployed 32 hungry goats to clear a section of Burke Street, a patch of overgrown shrubbery located behind the scrap exchange. Their job? Simply to eat. The waist-high hedges and amalgamation of vegetation made the paper street blend into the surrounding forestry, but it also makes a great goat snack. Paul's atypical gardeners, Bernie and Pastrami, two extra-friendly goats, continuously nudged for pets, while Paul explained the benefits of gardening with goats. Quote, if you go here and weed whack, seeds go flying everywhere and it's spreading, makes it worse. Goats, generally, when they eat seeds and they poop it out, the seed is actually destroyed in their rumen, so they're not spreading the seeds, which is a really cool thing. No thicket too thick, goats go where people can't, navigating steep and often risky terrain. Herbicides and power tools are hazardous to handle and leave pollutants in their wake. The only thing goats leave behind is fertilizer. Plus, they're partial to invasive species and problem vegetation. For instance, the highly invasive species kudzu threatens native ecosystems and suffocates other plants, but to goats, it's a high-protein dinner. Paul said the flowering parts of the kudzu have thousands of seeds in each flower. That's why it spreads so quickly. But goats and kudzu are a match made in heaven. The day after the initial clearing, with heaps of the brush already gone, local residents and government representatives celebrated the official launch of the Paper Streets Project with food trucks, face paint, and, of course, goats. Bernie and Pastrami, apparently crowd-pleasers, stole that show. Attendees of all ages gathered around the fence. Children's parents lifted them up to see over the brush, snapping and making smooching sounds to try to get the goats' attention. But it was really the other way around. The goats had people captured. Holland said goats are a great way for people to get oriented with the paper street and a great way for them to get a better visual of the space and what this paper street could be repurposed into. The strategy proved effective for Durham resident Cole Horton, who stumbled on the event while shopping at Scrap Exchange and said, "I think the goats are a great way to clear the lot, using animals instead of heavy machinery. I'd love to use it for something else, and I think it's great that city officials are all out here." Lined up to see these goats peppered through part of Burke Street, community members were quite literally at the forefront of the project, exactly as Holland intended. He said, "We wanted the community to be at the forefront, not the city, to help redesign and repurpose this paper street." A few yards away, locals crowded around the Neighborhood Improvement Service tent to give their input on what should become of the Burke Street property. After running out of four formal surveys, community members cast their votes by placing blue post-its all over the station table. Playground, community garden, picnic tables were among the most popular ideas. The Burke Street project as a pilot, is a pilot selected due to its proximity to Lakewood Shopping Center, the Scrap Exchange, and El Centro Hispano, locations familiar to most locals. Once Burke Street is finished, the city will, quote, conduct evaluations and see what worked well and what didn't, so that way when we look at other paper streets, we could use this as a model, as a testing, said Holland. Community design workshops and NC State College of Design charrettes to engage resident participation. Charrettes, never read that word, are anticipated in the early fall. Charrettes. Holland suggests keeping an eye out for posts on the Scrap Exchange website. Now, the project is an outgrowth of the Bloomberg Harvard City Leadership Initiative, a collaborative effort between Harvard University and Bloomberg Philanthropies aimed at strengthening city leadership. Mayor Williams and Holland are part of a cohort of more than 40 mayors and city officials on the initiative's innovation track. Last summer, the pair attended training courses in New York with Bloomberg officials and Harvard professors. Each mayor was responsible for identifying one issue to work on through this particular program. Paper streets seemed to be the clear choice for Mayor Williams and the city of Durham, saying, "I thought, well, we have acres of land that are unmaintained, undeveloped, and we should be able to better connect people. We're doing it in a very sustainable way with goatscaping and bringing the community together." Well, now, folks, that concludes my, let's call it heavy news or background news. And we'll now move to cultural things, called food things, whatever else we have time for. And the first is Indy Selects, this weekly What to Do in the Triangle this week. And it's a mixed bag of things to hear, see, and do. And usually something about six events. And here we go. Tomorrow, August the 1st, at Central Park, Durham, a playlist concert series, Bia Ferreira. Bia Ferreira describes her music as música de mulher preta, or black woman music, Brazilian singer, songwriter, and activist. And she's amassed over 40,000 monthly Spotify listeners and millions of YouTube views for her music. Her website describes it as funky beats, reggae, and soul ballad grooves. Now, she takes the stage on Friday for Playlist. That's Durham Central Park's free concert series. And her set starts at 7:30 p.m., but you'll want to get there early and stay out late. It's preceded by a mix from DJ Travis Gales and followed by a community-wide dance party. And, of course, we hope for good weather. There's rain in various forms projected for much of this, but the weekend itself is a little bit clearer with lower temperatures, too. Well, also on Friday, that was at 7 p.m., from 6 to 9 at Eno River Brewing in Hillsboro, the Uproar kickoff party. Uproar Festival of Public Art is a testament to tenacity when Chantal blew through Orange County. It damaged and destroyed local infrastructure and art spaces like the Eno Arts Mill, where festival organizers, that's the Orange County Arts Commission, keep studio space. Nevertheless, they're carrying on with that festival, which places 60 outdoor installations and murals by Southern artists across the county. And the August 1st kickoff party takes place at Eno River Brewing, where else, with live music by 10-piece band Liquid Pleasure, and food trucks, artist parade, printmaking activities, and a local photo booth. Bring your kids and make an evening of it, and a month of visiting and marveling at each respective installation. Next, in multiple theaters around the Triangle, the Cat Video Fest. It's a festival for cute cat videos. Need I say more? You've probably staged your personal cat video festival from your couch on Instagram Reels, but this international event is a chance to be around other feline lovers. 75 minutes of family-friendly footage, animations, music videos, and more content highlighting the cutest and possibly some of the dumbest cats you've ever seen. So, Durham's Carolina Theater, Raleigh's Alamo Draft House, and the Cary Theater are all participating in this far-flung project to bring the joy of silly feline content to the big screen. Each location also donates a portion of ticket sales to local shelters and organizations dedicated to cat welfare. This is August 1 and 2. That's Friday, when this broadcast first airs, and Saturday. And again, those three theaters, the Carolina Theater of Durham, the Alamo Draft House, and the Cary Theater in Cary. And you should go to their websites to find out what ticket prices might be. Then more film, Saturday, August 2nd at the Rialto, that's in Raleigh, Five Points in Raleigh, Triangle Native American Film Festival, a first of its kind and a chance to see, quote, a curated selection of native-made short films from around the world, including that 98-minute Sundance Institute Indigenous Short Film Tour. From the program notes, the program includes screenings of two shorts by North Carolina Lumbee filmmakers. The event, which runs from 2:30 until 9 p.m., includes a panel with filmmakers, producers, and actors, food trucks with local native chefs, and a filmmaking tutorial from the Indigenous Imagination Lab. It's also an opportunity to learn more about the event's organizer, that's the Triangle Native American Society. Ticket prices for this film festival start at $38.50. You could go to the Rialto Theater website and learn more. To listen to now, Saturday, August 2nd at 8 p.m. in Chapel Hill at the Cat's Cradle Back Room, Dissimilar South and Anne Claire. I was born to run away, working my whole life to stay. Separate cars to the same place, I'll be right behind, goes the song Baby Blues by Dissimilar South. That's the band project from Durham singer-songwriter Maddie Fisher. Their 2022 debut, Tricky Things, was chock full of similarly keen, emotionally savvy songwriting and soft twangs. Since then, the band has released two more very strong singles. So, at this Cat's Cradle Back Room show, Dissimilar South is joined by musician Anne Claire, who has been delivering infectious, no-holds-barred tunes to the Triangle for a decade now. Come close out the week, 8 p.m. Saturday, with an evening of soulful Southern tunes. Well, next, an interview with a local author. Libby Buck is her name, who from Hillsboro, North Carolina, has written what Sarah Edwards, the columnist, says is a gentle summer read about finding your way back home. And this is a Simon & Schuster release, which was just released on July 1, called Port Anna. All of a sudden, Libby Buck says, I had this image of a woman. Buck, a Hillsboro writer with a long red bob and impish Windsor glasses, is describing the moment she envisioned Gwen, the main character, in her debut novel, Port Anna, which was released earlier this month. Port Anna's Gwen is a woman unmoored as she leaves behind the boyfriend who dumped her and the Chapel Hill teaching job she was unjustly let go from and heads toward her childhood home of Port Anna, Maine. There, the past awaits, embodied by a slew of old high school friends, mostly men, the ramshackle cottage she grew up in, the cottage's pair of kindly ghosts, and memories of the sister she lost in childhood, a memory brought to the fore by posters of a missing girl, Shania, that pop up around Port Anna. When that image of Gwen first came to her, Buck says, it was of the character crossing Maine's real Piscataqua Bridge at 1 a.m. She recalls, I was like, what has happened to her? Then I started following the story of this woman and why she was in such terrible shape at the age of 40 and her life and how everything's been taken from her except this little, tiny, unwinterized cottage. Buck may live in Hillsboro, but Port Anna, as she says, is a love story to her childhood home of Maine. With the love of the state's lush landscape in all its quietly dramatic seasons, evident on every page, Gwen's journey and the prose that matches it are introspective and wise. A gentle summer read with a hometown romance unfolding across the pages as Gwen navigates grief, returning to both her home and herself and figuring out how to pick up the pieces. On the heels of this book publication, the indie spoke with Buck about Maine ghosts and how the book came to life. So this is characterized as a question and answer. What's your relationship to Maine like? That's a question that pretty much everyone asks, and it's a very common one to ask if you are in Maine, right? Everyone wants to know, how long have you had a relationship with this? How many generations does it go back? And seriously, if you're not like 18 generations in, you're just not a Mainer. My first summer in Maine, I was 2. My parents were living in New York City, and it was very hot, and my mother was miserable. She had a 6-month-old, and her sister had married into a family that lived a little bit south of here, closer to Portland. And she called my mom, who was complaining about New York, and her sister said, just stick the kids in the back of the station wagon and come on up. And so she did, and the way she tells it, she got out of the car and fell in love. When I was 7, my parents bought a little cottage, very light periwinkle, built by 2 women. We did call them the Misses. They were professors at Bryn Mawr, and the house was sold to us lock, stock, and barrel, so we sort of adopted them as members of our family. I have a number of photos that I show during my talks of these women. They're very tender. There's a lot of touching. It's very clear how much they loved each other. In their pictures, their friends came up, and they were all women. There are pictures of them swimming. They adopted kittens and would carry the kittens around. They're having tea on the outside porch. And anyway, it's very sweet. We grew to love them. There were also ghosts in the house. I never heard them. I think I was probably too young or unaware or oblivious. Evidently, my brother was the first one to hear them. He was a toddler. And one day during dinner, he looked to my mother and said, "Who's upstairs?" And my mother was like, "Oh, my God, there are footsteps up there, and there's nobody here but us." Ghosts usually have a negative connotation, but the ghosts in your book seem benevolent. My experience of Maine in general is, I just think of it as this magical, deeply spiritual space. It is a place where people talk about ghosts like they're just next door, you know. Oh, yeah, that house is haunted, like everybody knows that. I had an experience not so long ago of having dinner with some friends at a very old cottage that's right around the corner. It's this ramshackle place, and people know work has been done on it for quite some time. I looked at the hostess, and I said, "Is there a ghost here?" And she goes, "Oh, yeah, it's Uncle George." And at that very moment, the dog got up and went and stood at the bottom of the stairs and was looking up. everybody just kind of accepts that they're here, and they're not going to hurt anybody. Would you consider this a ghost novel? No. I mean, they're very present, but I was more interested in thinking about the things that haunt us, both to help and guide us. My main character, Gwen, is metaphorically haunted as well by the loss of her sister. As painful as that is for her, it's trauma that marks a life in indelible ways. I wanted to think about how you can heal from that kind of trauma and move forward. Sometimes those really difficult and painful things are teachers, too, and we can embrace the lessons that they bring. There's hope on the other side. What was the nucleus of the story? Well, I wanted to write this love story, and my agent says, that sounds like a great idea. I was so excited about writing this that I came back from my meeting and just started. Didn't have an outline. I didn't have a plan, which is a very bad idea, right? But once I started writing, I couldn't stop. I was thinking about how much it meant to me to get here and this Herculean effort over the years sometimes to make it up I-95, and all of a sudden, I had this image of a woman. Her hair is prematurely white at the temples, she's got bags under her eyes, and she's exhausted, and her life is falling apart. Question, are you working on a new project? I am. I'm working on a book about Shania. I finished Port Anna and so had so many questions about her. She's somebody who has suffered a great deal, and I wanted to understand how someone who has been through what she has been through can make sense of that as an adult. The linkage continues. Well, coming back to here, what is your writing life like? Have you been able to find a kind of writing home in North Carolina as well? Oh, my gosh, yes. First of all, I have the most extraordinary writing partner, and we've been writing together for 10 years. Alpen Geist is a writer of young adult sci-fi, and as a result, is extraordinarily plot-driven, which is very helpful for somebody like me, who's very description-heavy. It's been wonderful. And yes, I have met a number of other writers, and it's always lovely to be included in their midst. There are some very accomplished writers in Hillsborough and with long careers, so I'm always honored to be in a room with all of those people. Finally, how does it feel to have a book out in the world? I've had a lot of very sweet feedback from people, which makes me feel good. You know, when you write a book to make yourself happy, you don't always know if it's going to make someone else happy, so I'm just delighted when I get comments like, I cried, I love this, I love Gwen, love the misses. It's been really, really sweet. I had been warned that sometimes writers feel a letdown after publication day, but that has not been the case for me. So again, that's a book about Port Anna, her first book, and I don't know, I can't attest to whether Simon & Schuster has released an audio-only, for example, publication of it. It may be or it may be not. But if you're looking for something from somebody local, this might be a good bet. And I have to curtail some of this story, the last one in the Indie Week that I have the time to read. It's a character study of the MC Kyla Knott, subtitled The MILF with a Mic. She has many ways to describe her work as a drag, burlesque, and cabaret MC, ringmaster of the titty circus, Wish.com, Sabrina Carpenter, The MILF with a Mic, the mother of dad jokes. Professionally, though, Knott goes by Holly Pocket, a name inspired by the nostalgic pastel Polly Pocket dolls from Mattel. As a performer, Knott considers her own act cabaret, without the striptease of traditional burlesque, but she also has a drag character locked and loaded. Her name is National Trevor, says Knott. He's from South Carolina. Great board shorts and one of those beer hats. We've all met Trevor, and I feel like I could really do something with that. Knott lives in Raleigh and has performed all over North Carolina, but most often performs via her production company, Pocket Nightmare. She founded Pocket Nightmare in 2023 with another performer who goes by Nicolette Nightmare. They originally did most of their performances at Ruby Deluxe, which closed in May. She says, while the Triangle scene is diverse, welcoming, and fun, the landscape is shifting. Some venues have closed, either permanently or for remodeling, and she says there are more producers and performers than opportunities. Common performance venues include Legends, Pinhook, Chapel of Bones, and The Fruit, and there are a variety of local performers and groups. For those looking to learn, the Raleigh School of Burlesque offers intensive classes, or what they call shimmy seminars. Though she considers herself a chameleon, matching the themes of the events she hosts, Knott's own aesthetic has Polly Pocket-like femininity. The burlesque performances the night of our interview at Chapel of Bones in Raleigh were 1980s hair metal themed, but Knott still wore sparkly pink bow-shaped earrings along with her teased hair, blue shad eyeshadow, and fishnets. Even so, she did the famous Napoleon Dynamite dance on stage while pregnant, is dressing as Austin Powers for an event September, and stays open to new ideas. A stay-at-home mother of three, she studied drama and psychology in college and briefly worked in mental health care. She says she brings those skills with her onto the stage. And I will skip to the end of this article. And she says, when we see a performance on stage, it's one-of-a-kind show. It's never going to happen again. It's the first time I'm seeing it, the first time the other performers are seeing it, and it's just a one-of-a-kind little art piece. Knott's next performance is called MILF Madness, the Mother of All Shows, and the poster features a heavily pregnant Holly Pocket with a gold crown. And it will be August the 1st at Cannonball Music Hall, and the tickets for that are $20. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to John Feddersen reading the Independent, IndieWeek.com. You can find all these articles and their extreme backlog of articles from months and years gone by at IndieWeek.com. And we hope you'll be with us for my next issue, which will be in 1 week. And it's available as a podcast, each of these episodes, if you go to NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. So, for Indie Week, we'll see you next week. Bye.